Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Hope all had a wonderful holiday season. As you know, every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, which is January 8th, I am delighted to welcome Dave Morgan, who is the CEO of, and I'm hopefully say it's correctly, Simul Media. It's one of those hybrid words. Dave, did I get the name of your company correctly?
Exactly. No, it's Simul Media. So things like simulcast, Simul Media.
Oh, we can barely hear you. You're a little bit garbled.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you, but it's still pretty garbled. Are you on a cell phone?
I'm not, but I'm on a. I'm going to try another phone. I'm going to call right back in on that other phone, okay?
Okay, great. Sounds good. So Dave will be back with us in a second, as you heard. And if you haven't heard of his company, which we'll get the correct pronunciation of, I think it's Simul. It's Simulmedia. And it's a very interesting concept in terms of where it sits in the ad industry. I'm really excited to tackle kind of advertising as we start the new year, because there are so many aspects of monetization that I think have been talked about for a long time that based on technology we're able to actually accomplish and get to. And Dave, is that you with us now?
Yes, I'm back. Is that better?
Fantastic. You sound great.
so you were close with the name, but it's Simul Media, like simulcast.
Got it. I love the name. You could take it a lot of different ways. But I'm really excited to be kicking off the new year for the show talking about basically advertising and monetization.
Uh-huh.
And as I understand it, the aim of your company is to improve the impact of TV program promotions. Does that kind of capture what it aims to do, or does it do much more?
Well, that's where we're starting. We look at it as the one category of television advertising that's probably most important, because if the television networks and programmers cannot build audiences for their shows, you know, that's sort of the foundation of their businesses crumble. And with the explosion of choices today in television and the audience fragmentation, it's a real problem. And but the techniques that we're using and are developing are ultimately expected to apply across all of the categories of television and video advertising.
Got it. So it could include online video then too.
Yes. Yeah. We're not focused as much on online because, quite frankly, the online video platform doesn't really lack optimization. I mean, you can do an awful lot with the advertising. Probably the biggest thing holding back online video is just usage.
And television
has the opposite problem. Television has massive usage that's still growing. I mean, more people. I mean, what's amazing is, in spite of the challenges that the television industry faces, there's never been a time when more people. I mean, the more people watch more television today than they did last year, than the year before, and it's continuing to grow. But the advertising techniques are still, 40 years old.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. And we'll get into that a little bit.
Yeah.
It's dinosaur land, unfortunately. So, without, getting too deep into the specifics, how does your solution work, kind of, and does it fit into a category that exists, or is it really creating a new category?
Well,
advertising.
Yeah. Hopefully it's going to fit within existing categories. I think if you try to change behavior too much in an industry that's been around this long, you can find yourself starving for a long time. So, uh, But basically what we do is we're focused on making television advertising better, and particularly program promotion better. And the simple way to think about it is today, if you watch television, it is impossible for you to know all of the shows that are on television that you might enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not possible. There are so many choices of so much programming, you can watch so many different ways. Now, that was not the case 20 years ago or 25 years ago, when you had 10 or 13 or 20 channels, and you really had, you know, three dominant networks. It was, you know, everybody pretty much knew what was on they might enjoy, but you can't now. So there, you know, so there's a lot of, it's a real discovery problem for the viewer. And
mm-hmm.
and if you ask people and you watch people that watch television, the number one way that people find out about television programming is from on-air program promotion. Word of mouth is a pretty close second, but the number one way is that it's sampled is when you're watching television, you see promos for other shows.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those promos that are delivered, basically the same promos are given to everybody at the same time in the same shows.
Mm-hmm.
No matter where they live in the country, no matter what they like. And that's been fine. It hasn't been an issue for the industry because the industry hasn't been under pressure until recently. But isn't it, you know, it's interesting that movie theaters in different neighborhoods show different movies,
mm-hmm.
reflecting the cities and the towns and the neighborhoods. Blockbuster video rental stores feature different rentals in different towns and in different neighborhoods, but everybody in the country gets the same program promotions. So
mm-hmm.
what we're focused on are trying to develop a science around people's interest in television programming and ultimately other consumer goods and services, and then delivering, in this case, program promotions that are more relevant to what they're interested in. And rather than trying to do one-to-one marketing, which a lot of people are starting to try to build systems to do, which I think is going too far too fast before the market's ready, it's trying to improve television program promotions by basically changing the scheduling of the promotions to better reflect what people are interested in. And it could be changed geographically. It could be changed, you know, at the neighborhood level or city level. It could be by placing promotions in other shows or at other times where the data tells us that the people that would be most interested in those shows are, even if it's non-intuitive or counterintuitive. And the way we do that is we're licensing anonymous set-top box data
mm-hmm.
from television operators, cable operators, satellite operators, telco operators.
Okay. And I was going to ask you, where does the data come from?
Yeah. And so, you know, currently today we have set-top box data, anonymous set-top box data, on tens of millions of viewers in the United States. And we can see second by second what kind of programming the people watch, and then we can also see of people that watch one kind of programming, what other kind of programming do they watch? And you can start to develop patterns in the notion of birds of a feather flock together.
Right.
The people that like this show also like this show. And you can also start finding out how responsive people are to the program promotions they see, because you can see what viewers saw which program promotions and did they in fact watch the show or not. So you can take something that really has had virtually no science or very little science before, and you can make it very scientific and very predictable. And what we've discovered so far is that based on this anonymous set-top box data, you can predict 70% of what a household is going to watch with 99% accuracy.
Wow.
So this is far more predictable, and most of my experience has been in the online world. This is far more predictable than web browsing.
Mm-hmm.
What we've also learned, and I guess it's intuitive if you watch television, is that probably 80% of on-air program promotions today are wasted. They're redundant or irrelevant or ineffective. So this isn't a case where there's 50% of the advertising, to use the Wanamaker quote, you know, is being wasted. This is about 80%.
Wow. So how is it that you know people, because you mentioned kind of categories in which they don't respond. So they must, there must be behaviors that show you that they don't respond in certain buckets.
Right. So here's some of the kinds of things we've learned. First, people tend to be very loyal. Well, there's different degrees of loyalty that people have towards television and networks and shows.
Right.
The hardcore loyalists to programs are much fewer and further between than there used to be. And actually, it's a minority of television viewers that are actually really loyal to specific television programs, you know, probably in the 30% range, maybe 35%. The majority of viewers are samplers. They're grazers. They are loyal to their television. They're loyal to certain times, days and times that they watch television, and they're loyal to certain genres of programming. But they are no longer loyal to specific programs and specific networks. And most importantly, are highly persuadable, they're very persuadable when presented with relevant on-air program promotions the day of their viewing.
Shorter attention span.
It is, and it's natural. I mean, they're overwhelmed with choice, and it's sort of like the power of the end-of-aisle display or the point-of-sale in a grocery store. In the days when grocery stores only had a couple thousand items, people were more likely to know what they wanted. But, today the average grocery store, I think, has about 50,000 to 60,000 different stock units. So the real power now is not just about – it's no longer about shelf placement. It's about what's at the end of the aisle or what's at the cash register. And that's sort of what's going on with program promotion.
Finish.
I was just going to say, a relevant program promotion delivered the day of a program will drive what we'll call a view-through rate, a response rate of almost 10% on average. I mean, that's amazing when you think about it. That it can be that the people are essentially that suggestible. And I don't know that it's suggestible. I would say in some ways it's desperate. A lot of people turn their television on the majority of people turn their televisions on clearly not knowing what they want to watch or what they're going to watch.
So does this mean that, from the data that you're seeing, that appointment television is sort of over?
I don't think appointment television is over. People clearly have appointments with their TVs. The notion of do they still have appointments with certain shows, that is clearly in decline.
Right.
So, this is something that's pretty fundamental to this industry, which is more people are more loyal to televisions today than they have ever been before. And there's more programming. It's of higher quality. I mean, there's lots of qualitative issues, obviously, determining that. But, and it's on better devices with many more choices. So there's clearly appointment viewing. I mean, households are very predictable as to when their televisions are going to be turned on. But, are we ever going to see an era again of everybody having to be in front of their TVs to watch an episode of MASH? Or Friends, we're not going to see nearly as much of that clearly, and that's changing a lot.
So relative to that, with the idea that your data-driven and scientific development around this type of, around advertising specifically for program spots, does that mean that the goal is to, what is the goal? Because if it's not, well, is it to bring back that sense of this is when something's on, or?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple things, and some of them are pretty sort of practical or pragmatic, that it is possible to build bigger audiences for television shows by better promoting the programs to the people that are interested. And because the audiences are fragmenting now across so many channels, most networks, in the old days, networks could just put program promotions on their own network and they would always reach the viewers that would be interested, and it was pretty easy. But now mm-hmm. you have to go to where the viewers are, and they're on lots of other channels.
Mm-hmm.
So it means the broadcast networks have to do a lot of off-channel on-air program promotion on cable network channels.
Mm-hmm.
So number one is, how can you help these programmers build audiences for their shows? It's no longer going to be enough to just get someone to watch the first or second episode of a season and then expect they'll be loyal all the way through. These
mm-hmm.
people are going to have to be reminded every week. People are going to have to sort of, you know, sing for their supper a little bit when they didn't have to before. The networks are going to have to work for their viewers to get their viewers and to let them know it. Also, it's going to mean that the smaller networks and the more niche and obscure programs are now going to have chances to build audiences. Marketing is much more important. I mean, what's happened in the media world is that in the world of analog media, distribution was king because distribution was scarce.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a certain amount of broadcast spectrum that's government controlled, or a certain amount of printing presses, and distribution was very expensive. In the digital world, distribution is no longer scarce. It's plentiful. It's attention that's scarce. And so it used to be you just put the show on the channel and you had an audience. Not anymore. Now you got to put the show on the channel or make it available. It doesn't have to be on the channel. It can be almost anywhere. It can be on demand, maybe on, you know, Hulu, you know, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to market now. I mean,
yep.
I mean, really what it's come down to is, if you are a television programming company, you now have to really market. And spray and pray marketing, which has been virtually, you know, what the almost virtually all of the marketing on television today is really spray and pray, isn't going to be good enough anymore. It's going to have to be more focused, more targeted, better measured. And we've been running some field trials over the last few months with some of the shows that launched this fall. And you know, we're seeing lifts of 50 to 400% in the responsiveness of audiences to promotions. Just by applying some predictive data models to the scheduling of spots.
Wow. So do you have any examples you can share?
I can't share them yet because...
We'll be looking for that first white paper.
we're hoping
that's
in the next
amazing.
Couple months. Yeah, we're hoping in the next couple months. I mean, it exceeded our expectations. Having spent so much time in the online world where things are already so optimized, you know,
yep.
we haven't been used to big lifts like that. But, you know, if you think about it, I mean, I tell people ask, like, why did I leave after 19 years working in online advertising? Why am I, you know, now in television? And, well, part one is I never really left. I mean, online is now, television is becoming part of online. So
yeah, it's all kind of intermixed.
Yes. But the other part is that if you think of it, in the online advertising world market in the United States, about a $25 billion a year market. About half of that is display advertising. And that half is on an annual basis, it's pretty much flat in growth, and it's already 80 to 90% optimized with technology and data. But the television world, you know, the market's probably a $65 billion a year market. It's also flat.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's 10% or 20% optimized with technology and data. And
so,
that's going to change.
So I'm curious. So obviously there are sort of three buckets of generations. There's the boomers, the Xers, and the millennials. And I wonder if, we've spent some time on this show talking about the millennial generation and their viewing patterns, habits, as it relates to social media and lots of other things. And I'm wondering if, you're sort of a pioneer of behavioral targeting and other kinds of targeting, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the behavioral patterns among, the TV behavior patterns among those demographics, if you get that kind of data.
Well, we do look at some demographic overlays, but we don't get too focused on it because I think that age, the classic socio-demographic segmentations tend to deceive you more than they help you.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly someone that's 18 has some predictable differences from someone that's 78, but maybe not as much as most people think. And
yeah,
so,
I totally agree.
And so for us, the person's a viewer, and they exhibit a certain kind of loyalty to their television, the days and times they watch, the kinds of programming they watch, and potentially the network or channel and the program. And if you sort of don't let other things distract you and you focus on that, you can do a better job giving them more relevant programming and better media choices. I don't think that there is we've not seen anything to tell us that there's a dramatic difference in their responsiveness to the on-air program promotions. I would probably intuitively say, the millennials are certainly relying more on other electronic sources of information for what they're going to watch, whether that's email, texting, Twitter, things like that. Because clearly word of mouth is important in television, and a lot of the real-time web is really powering that. I do think that is going to be an enormous factor.
They're much more
viewing choices.
They're tons more loyal than Xers. My sense is, for myself working in the TV industry for a long time, I have a feeling that once more data comes out about usage, whatever their source of media is, that Xers will be the ones that skew, and Boomers and the Millennials will be much more alike. Because they're much more willing to be loyal. They're much more traditional. They're much more they think collectively. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Possibly, yeah, possibly. But I've sold ads for the better part of the last 20 years, and it's always fascinating that as much as I hear marketers talk about the demographic buckets. In the end of the day, what it comes down to is, who buys their products, and in this case, who watches the programming. I think that the broad generalizations may actually sort of distract you or deceive you as much as they add value. I think that I actually think that in some cases it may be less about the person and sometimes about the environment. And we've been looking at a lot of areas we'll call modality, which are, why is someone watching? Sometimes you watch to escape. Sometimes you watch to be included. Sometimes you watch to participate. And I think understanding those things may be much more important than trying to generalize the person. And probably their responsiveness, I think that's one of the reasons why we find that an on-air program, a program promotion delivered the day of a show is four times more effective than one delivered the day before. Now, clearly part of that is because a lot of people, still haven't made their mind up as to what they're going to watch. So clearly it wasn't that they are just dying to watch a particular show. It's that they're looking to their television for something else, whether that's escape or entertainment or to laugh or, whatever those things are. And the program itself is a lot less important to them than the medium, the platform.
Got it. So that makes – I'm sorry, go ahead.
But I think that is going to be. I think that's more important than how old they are. And I think that. I think that. I mean, yeah, it's a bit trite to refer to it, but I mean, you know, McLuhan told us that the medium is the message, and that all too often we want to focus so much on sort of what's in the package, and we don't realize that that may not be the way that sort of, you know, that most humans, you know, act and receive media. It may be more about the platform and the medium that delivers it. So, I think that's, you know, but the good thing is we're just going to follow the numbers, and the data tells us. And so we obviously have to blend a certain amount of art with it and understand programming and people and their behaviors and psychology. But ultimately the data tells us, and, you know, as I said, fortunately it's very clear that the area of on-air program promotion under-optimized, that there's a lot of room for improvement. And I'm sure we're going to see the same thing eventually when we look at consumer packaged goods or automotive advertising or all of the other categories.
So this, you know, reminds me, you know, earlier when you were talking about kind of the buckets that people, you know, are looking for when they're looking for programming, you know, do they want to laugh? Why are they watching? You know, kind of backing up from before they're at the TV, you know, why are they there? And I think about my on-demand screens because, you know, each of them have these detailed lists of movies, you know, that are pre-screened for me into, you know, comedy or whatever. So obviously, you know, on-demand is, you know, my on-demand box, cable box is thinking that way, or the people behind it are thinking that way. How does on-demand play into all of this?
It's going to become a really big part of it. I mean, on-demand, you know, on-demand is important to people in the TV industry. It's probably not important to most consumers, and it's certainly not important to my 5 and 6 year old daughters. You know, they don't understand that. You know, that for them, the television, they don't know whether it's coming off a Roku box or it's just a different remote control, but they don't know, you know, it's the television.
Mm-hmm.
We bucket things into categories that way because, and it's really because of legal and business decisions. You know, what are the release windows and who can sell it, which way, when, and where are the deals. So I think that to the extent that we're seeing the loyalty to specific programs and or specific networks decline, and people going much more broadly to many more sources than they used to, looking at more channels, that on-demand and some, you know, we're going to see ultimately a blurring of what we know of as on-demand and DVR and time-shifted.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think this means that the appointment viewing goes away. It's actually one of the reasons we picked the name simulmedia, is I still think one of the most important things about television is the simultaneous shared consumption of it. And I think networks and programmers and, you know, social web companies will do a lot to make sure people can, you know, can share the experience. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think a lot of the somewhat artificial differentiations as to where the programming came from will go away. And I think that we'll probably, you know, I don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but it's clearly broken right now, and I'm pretty confident that as consumers are given better experiences, it will improve. I think that for example, let's use on-demand as, you know, if you watch most, you know, depending on the market you're in, who your cable provider is,
mm-hmm.
or satellite provider, you can be pretty certain that you're going to see virtually no promotions for on-demand programming when you're on normal channels. So unless
mm-hmm.
you go there and seek it, you're not going to know about it. Now, that there's a couple times that's different. There's some deals that will be done for like a big blockbuster or some special sports or music event that they'll promise to drive a certain amount of promotions. But
right.
it doesn't make much sense, because if you like certain kinds of programming – at certain times, I mean, not only doesn't it make sense to be promoted to you in the same kind of 30-second or 10-second or 15-second spots that the other programming is? But actually, if you're the operator, it's probably even more beneficial to you because you get to keep that money yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, that's one of the areas we're focusing on also, is that, you know, there's a real economic benefit here for the operators and the studios, the programming owners, to start using the on-air program promotions intelligently to drive sales of on-demand programming, and or probably what would be delayed viewing usage as well.
Right.
Now that we're seeing, you know, now that Cablevision won their lawsuit, and we're going to see essentially DVRs in the sky now. So, you know, anything that's on available on television is basically available to everybody who's, you know, who's a subscriber.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of where I live. So I have Comcast. Pretty much everything's on demand. Certain things aren't, which surprises me, because I take them off the DVR, because then, you know, why waste space? I can just watch it on demand. And there mm-hmm. are literally shows, and I know I'm not alone in this, and it might be, you know, geographical, you know, partly where I live and how other people, you know, use theirs as well. But, I mean, one of the benefits to me is I just hit that tab and, like, for example, The Good Wife, stumbled upon it one mm-hmm. time. I have no idea when that's on. The only reason I even care to find out if it's on is if I see something in my reader or something about ratings. If the ratings were lagging, I would make sure I watched it within the window that I knew Nielsen counts. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I have no clue, and I am so amazed at how bad the advertising is that's there, because I'm one of those people that, you know, show me, yeah. you know, give me ad breaks that make sense. So, you know, if you, for example, in the UK, I mean, they tend to be very good about, you know, here's part one, here's part two, here's part three. So there's sort of a, even if it's not a beginning, middle, and end, it comes to a point where it doesn't just, so Mad Men is a really good example of this to me. Love that show. Now, that was appointment viewing for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved the show, but the problem was being on AMC, they have ads, and they would cut off at just like the worst points. I mean, it was like dramatic climax. Cut away, and you know, it would mess up, like her looking at him or him looking at her, or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever that was. So, which would make me so angry that I would rather wait, not look online to see what happened in the episode and read Alan Sepinwall's blog, which was my favorite, or is my favorite, on Mad Men and other things, and watch it after the fact, so I could go through the commercials, because I was so angry to have to watch them. And I wonder if, you know, programmers look at that. You know, are we showing ads at the, you know, wrong time? Should we be, you know, considering the, you know, the dramatic cadence? I'm happy, you know, in online video, show me an ad before and after the clip, and I'll watch it. Or The Good Wife does this too. They do two ads during the program, both advertise CBS shows. Usually there's a Criminal Minds during the middle of it, and a Fringe at the end, or Mentalist at the end. But I feel like that's part of it too, you know, kind of understanding that people just don't want to be interrupted watching these things if we've, you know, made the time to make something appointment viewing.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And, you know, the reason it's like this is up until a few years ago, it didn't matter. There weren't enough choices, and the audience numbers were great, and the margins were high, and no one needed to change anything because, you know, the economics worked well. But that, you know, it's been slowly changing for the last 10 or 15 years, and now it's rapidly changing, and it's really putting the television industry in a tough spot. And so now they are going to have to, you know, now they have to care about, you know, it really now is all about capturing the attention of the audience and being friendlier to the audience. And what I think is going to make the biggest difference, and obviously it's where we're focused, is the opportunity we have now is this data available. We now can know what the audiences do around every ad pod. We know exactly when they leave, and we know, I mean, for example, that's one of the real low areas of low-hanging fruit for networks that we're starting to work with, is the fact that invariably, these networks are dramatically oversaturating their audience with the same promos for the same shows over and over and over and over again. And in most cases where if you delivered a frequency of 20 or 30 promos for a certain show in a week to a person, there are networks out there that are delivering 500 promos for the same show to the same household, same person. And, I mean, not only is that ineffective, it's really, really annoying.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about your marginal audiences that don't care as much, how many are just getting pissed off and saying, I'm done, sorry, like, I can't take this anymore. And now we can measure that. Now, you know, that's, fortunately, that's the area we're very focused on. So, you know, there's probably at least a dozen or 15 companies that are using set-top box data for advanced advertising applications, you know, at some sort of scale. So when you asked earlier about a category, I would say, you know, a lot of people are calling it sort of advanced television, but I guess more of sort of insider baseball. But the data can tell us, and we know. And we know that the pods are being managed badly. We know that the way that the breaks are handled by the operators of the cable networks can create a lot of problems. And we also know that it's very easy to see that in the data. And also, you don't have to do that much to improve it a little bit. You know, it's not that hard to figure out how to, for example, reschedule the on-air promos to make sure that instead of giving the same audiences the same promo 500 times, you do a better job sort of spreading them around because you know the other kinds of programming people watch. And hopefully, you know, this is going to improve the viewer's experience for television, which I think it has to be improved.
Yeah, I just wonder how much they're watching these, you know, I mean, I know that, you know, there's the sort of traditional where I still go, God, I can't believe how ad breaks are handled so poorly. And then there's the on-demand, which is, it has, like, they've regressed. I mean, if you watch, for example, Top Chef, they the same ad for, it's Tom Cochillo, I guess, is one of the, if I'm saying his name correctly. Anyway, they have one ad, and they'll do it 14 times in one on-demand episode of him flogging Diet Coke. Now, I'm a loyal Diet Coke drinker, but I'm happy to tweet to Diet Coke going, don't do that. Don't even bother advertising with someone who is going to piss me off, you know, and it's like it gets emotional because it's like, first of all, I mean, you know, it seems like there's, I mean, it gets laughable because it's got it. I mean, my husband starts whistling the tune actually when the ad break comes because we know what it's going to be. There's been no other ad for it all season, and it's we watch on demand, and it's just laughable, and it's like, you know, TV is regular programmatic television on the other side is you know way ahead, and you're talking about optimizing that, you know, who's going to optimize on demand or that horrible video box that comes up?
And the reason why is that first, the groups that manage the on demand and most of the operators are very small, and the only revenue that there's any focus on in the on demand for most of these folks is the actual subscriber payment. And so the free on demand, that they just want that there to try to, you know, generally add more value to the service, but it's not being measured. So
yeah,
like, okay, yeah, throw that feature in. You know, we put that as part of our, if you have the digital tier, you take this tier, you take that tier, you get that. And that's all it's about. And then there's not anyone there that actually is concerned what the actual consumer experience is unless it is demonstrated as creating more churn. But they don't even know because most of them don't have that data.
I was just going to say, I don't think they're measuring it because,
no.
And I mean, Comcast doesn't lack for money. We both know that. And, you know, the fact that I know they're not, I can tell they're not measuring it, you know, I mean, it is pretty, pretty poor.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone in my demo that I know watches television that way, you know, and it's just the ultimate convenience, you know, when I'm, you know, it's all in HD and might have to wait a little longer for HD. So if I don't want to do that, I can watch the regular, you know, version of it. And, you know, it just amazes me. But, you know,
well,
I mean,
sorry. But I think what's going to happen, though, is, as I say, there has been so much sort of stability in this market for so long. And that stability is changing very quickly. And so I think what's going to happen is that we're going to see some of the market participants start taking advantage of data and new technology and ways to apply it, and are going to develop some leadership over their competition that way. And then once it gets painful enough for some of the slower incumbents, you know, they're either going to have their business models erode, or they're going to do the same thing too. So I love this frustration that you're describing and everybody else, because I know that television experience can be made dramatically better than it is today. I mean, still, the fact that the television viewing and the average amount of time that people spend on television relative to all other media has continued to increase for TV, or has held steady over the last 15 years, while the internet has taken 20% of people's media consumption time. That says a lot. Says that TV is really something extraordinary. So with a platform this strong, the fact that it's still so screwed up, that's just tons of opportunity. And if you look at, you know, the market, the amount of money spent on home entertainment subscription and payments for video is almost double what's spent on advertising. It's almost $130 billion a year in the U.S. So a lot of money out there in play. And consumers now can vote, with their mouses and their remotes, and they couldn't before. Mm. And we can now track that and measure that, and we can potentially change where they go. And so, you know, I think we're going to see it. It's sort of funny. I mean, I liken it to, I know this is a very good example to use, but
go for it.
You know, for all of us that fly on airplanes a lot, I mean, it was, you know, one of the most frustrating things always was these incredibly long lines to get your paper ticket at the counter, which of course means you have to get your travel agent to mail you your paper ticket or get it FedEx to you, because you know, if you're going to have to check bags, you just knew you were going to. How come, isn't it interesting that JetBlue launches, they launch with a self-serve kiosk, which everybody that started using them realized what a dramatically better experience it was. I mean, dramatic. How come, don't you find it incredible that it didn't take more than about 2 years for virtually the entire rest of the airline industry to implement it?
Yeah, absolutely. Some better than others.
Yeah. They knew it, and they already knew about the technology. The technology was already available, and they probably had already tested it. So, but they didn't have to. The competition wasn't forcing them to make that change, and probably would have, you know, probably a big union issue, I'm sure. There have been probably a dozen, you know, security issues, probably dozens and dozens of issues that they did not want to have to confront, and they did not confront it because they could get by without it, until an airline started really changing the game by using it, among other things, and then suddenly everyone had to do it. And so I think that's what's going to happen here in television, is that, you know, over the next, I think in the next 3 or 4 years, it's going to be, we're going to see some really dramatic changes in television. And we're going to see some players go away. We're going to see some new players emerge. We're going to see some real shifts in consumer behavior. And a lot of money, I mean, tens of billions of dollars is going to be displaced and moved from some companies to others, depending on how it comes out.
So one question I have for you, and then I want to ask you about your predictions for the rest of the year. But before we get to that, how much do you see actual advertisers increase there's a couple of ad campaigns or companies that have basically underwritten shows. So the Starter Wife was one of them on USA a while back, and so there were fewer ad breaks, and it was all sponsored by, God, I can't even remember now. So there was that. And then now there's that soap opera within a soap opera commercial for, I think, a detergent company that's on during the day, targeting soap opera watchers. You know, and then you have, you know, sort of the other model, I guess, because I think of these as sort of three different ways of the advertiser being involved. There's, you know, without talking about product placement, the other is, you know, sort of underwriting a show. So mm-hmm. I think BMW, you know, for the season premiere of Mad Men, I think it was them that sponsored all of the, you know, the entire show without ad breaks or with limited interruption, maybe one ad break or something. Now, I'll tell you, if that had been any consumer product or if I needed a car, I would have considered them hugely because of that. How much are those kinds of advertising sort of programmatic or having a different kind of relationship to the program advertising? How much does that play into things?
I think that's going to be a big part of the future. I was just at CES,
yes,
the Consumer Electronics Show yesterday, and there was a gentleman there from Fremantle, the folks who make all the reality programming. And he said one of the things that really struck him, he came out of the UK market originally, and he's been in the US market for 7 years now. So one thing that struck him was that no one from the client or the agency even talked to them about how the product could potentially tie into the show until after they had made their media buy.
Oh, wow.
Which sort of tells you it was, you know, the tail wagging the dog. Which is like, okay, yeah, we've already bought some spots here. Now maybe we should see if we can actually do something with the show. And he said in the UK it was always quite opposite. And that you went to the show first to see how it could work, and then if you really found the way that you could work into the show well, then, of course, you supported it with your marketing and your spots. And he said, now, he said in the last year and a half, he has seen that change a lot in the U.S. And so I think that's what's going on. And here's the simplest reason why. I actually don't think many viewers – I mean, this isn't some great revelation. I don't think many viewers like the interruptive ads, irrelevant ads. I mean, it doesn't make it a better experience. And because viewers are becoming more in control, it means that too many ads that don't tie in or relate to the program are going to go away. And the fact that now it's very easy – There are fewer advantages to being on a large, big network than just having your programming available on demand if people know it's there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we're going to see is we're going to see much more commercially created, commercially influenced, commercially inspired programming, and then we're going to just see a better job of marketing to make sure that people are aware of it and can find it. And you know, that's actually the way a lot of the secondary sports are shown on U.S. television.
My husband being English, yes, we watch cricket. I mean, that affects our decision on who – we had DirecTV for years just because that's the way we could get the Ashes every 2 years. So
even a sport like tennis, outside of the U.S. Open for U.S. tennis tournaments, all of the other tournaments that show up on – the broadcast network, their time buys.
Mm-hmm.
The sponsor, let's say the sponsor of the Miami tournament, you know, or one of the big tournaments says, hey, look, I'm only going to pay X amount of millions as long as you're going to be on one of the big networks. So you better take that money and buy, you know, give whatever it requires to a big network to make sure that we've got, you know, 6 hours of weekend coverage for our semifinals and finals. And that's how it's done. It's totally, essentially, commercially driven.
I always give the example of how we watch UK programming that isn't commercially available any other way by using a media server. So we stream to our PS3 or our Xbox. So we get, you know, the commentary. So, for example, Channel 9 in Australia is usually what we get for cricket, which, you know, is incredible. You know, Australians are, you know, like English with ego, right? So they actually, it can be irritating for an English person to watch. So in any event, we watch that. We just stream it. And it's pretty much in real time for us because we're working during the day. It's downloading because it's finished. And then we sit at home and watch it through the PS3, and we're watching that on our television. It doesn't make any difference to us. And the same thing, you know, with TV shows. So The Restaurant, you know, there was a big uproar over who won that the last version of that series, and we've kind of followed the news about that, you know, kind of from afar.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's the same thing. It's like this, talk about time shifting. I mean, you're literally watching, you know, later in the day the same show that your friends did that just
mm-hmm.
happened to live in England. So I think with Asia and just the world becoming more of a world market, there's going to be more of that. I think that's going to be more mainstream because, I mean, that, you know, online for us kind of started with rugby
mm-hmm.
World Cup, Wimbledon, you know, IBM and Wimbledon, and IBM has a great player for Wimbledon sport, you know, tennis, and, you know, there's, you know, people were forced to use online, but they went, you know, a step further, and, you know, I remember my husband used to have this long lead and actually connect his computer to the TV,
mm-hmm.
and that was only, like, what, 3 or 4 years ago,
yeah.
And now it's just streamable by media server.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the things that certainly came out, I mean, probably the biggest theme, I mean, I think in my view, the biggest theme I saw at the Consumer Electronics Show this year was connected devices.
Mm.
And now that everything, you know, now the virtual, you know, most homes that are on the net are on broadband and they have Wi-Fi in the home. Making that available to the TV screen and other screens, there's so much easy, simple hardware to do that now that, that becomes as easy and elegant of a choice to use as on-demand from those cable operators. So,
oh, yeah.
So this is coming, I mean, so this is now coming fast, and I think, you know, I mean, hopefully, you know, our belief that being able to get a platform together now, they can better predict what people are going to want to watch and better inform them of what's available, so be able to sort of aggregate attention for people with programming. And as I say, I don't think it's just going to be the big networks or the classic shows. It's going to be advertisers who have gone and built the programming themselves and went straight to the studios.
Yeah, exactly.
and they're going to put it up. And, you know, why not? You know, if it's, you know, it's so easy to do. And for a lot of these, you know, I mean, depending on the advertiser, there are a lot of advertisers that are, you know, that have goods that are sold at retail where there's lots of screens and they need to have great programming anyway available, you know, whether it's a shoe company to be showing in the Foot Lockers or book publishers in Barnes & Noble or, you know, whatever those things are. So they need the programming anyway, so why not make it and then pay to distribute it and basically sit on a channel and buy promos in, you know, with some degree of science, because obviously they won't have the massive budgets that the large TV networks have, but with some degree of precision to know that the audiences that you're most interested are going to be aware that the program is there and that they can watch it.
It would be so much easier. Well, with that thought, quickly, because we only have a few more minutes, I'd love to hear your top 5 predictions in television advertising for over the course of 2010.
Okay, I think on a gross spend basis, it's going to be an all right year. I don't think it's going to be either, you know, significantly up or significantly down, but I think it's going to be flat. So that's actually probably not a bad thing because I don't think I'm not that bullish on the economy, given the fact that unemployment seems like it's going to be up for a while. So spend will be flat. I think we're going to start seeing a lot more focus on results and performance and away from a lot of more traditional media metrics. And that won't happen overnight, but I think 2010, we're going to start seeing more of that, a lot more accountability. And one of the reasons is that you've got digital people now taking over big jobs and big agencies. I mean, Group M announced that Rob Norman, their digital guy, is now running Group M North America.
Right.
So a different degree of accountability. The third thing is I do think we're going to start seeing the television platform be used by more advertisers. It's not going to be dramatic, but I think this year we'll start seeing, and I don't know that it's the Google TVs that are going to do it as much as that there will be a recognition that TV is pretty powerful, and we'll see some other advertisers, maybe some that have left newspapers particularly and written magazines start using television in focused ways. I think that we are going to see some, I mean, we know we've got one big merger planned to be completed this year, but I think we're going to see some significant consolidation and movement. There's a lot of companies with some balance sheet problems, and there's companies that have some revenue problems and cost problems. And so we're going to see some reshuffling of some of the TV companies. And that's three or four. And I think, I guess I'll say finally, I actually think we are going to see something around this notion of TV everywhere. And I think it's going to be more than just, let's say, a bargaining chip between programmers and the cable networks. I think we're going to see some companies trying to deliver a more seamless experience of television across platforms. I mean, the things that you described, you and your husband have done, to be able to watch programming you really care about and setting up servers and doing this or doing that, I think some companies are going to use all of the things that have been developed in the online and web world in the last 15 years, the cloud computing and cloud storage and the prediction kinds of algorithms of the Netflix and Amazon, to start building some pretty meaningful interfaces that may start pulling together these different deliveries into a more meaningful TV screen. I guess I'll say that was four and five. I don't think that 2010 is going to be the year of the 3D TV.
Yeah, I don't either. So I'm glad we agree on that.
No way in the world. I don't think we're going to go back to the 50s and have people like come into the living room and put their glasses on to watch TV, except for gaming. So the 3D TV will be the overhyped 2010 promise.
Yeah, I hope not. But yeah, we'll see how that plays out. Well, Dave Morgan, I thank you so much for joining the program today. You had fascinating things to say. We didn't even get into the history you have with behavioral targeting and so many other things that are so interesting. So we'll have to have you back on at some other time. And thank you for being on, flying back from CES so quickly.
Well, I enjoyed it, and thank you. And have a great weekend, and to all your listeners as well.
All right. Thanks, Dave. We'll let you get on with your day. And thank you to everyone who tuned into the A-List today with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Again, we hope you enjoyed the program. And if so, we'd love it if you'd be so kind as to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to tune in next week when my featured guest is Ryan Kahlo. He is the academic fellow, or an academic fellow, at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford, which you may remember is the center Lawrence Lessig brought to fame. That's 1 week from today at 12 noon Pacific. We have a number of other exciting guests lined up for you in the new year, including Shell Israel, Seth Godin, Joanna Drake-Earl, Kara Swisher, Charlene Lee, just to name a few. So be sure to connect with us. You can get me on Twitter at Jennifer. As always, keep up with the latest on this show and archives at jenniferlindsay.com, and have a fantastic weekend, everyone. Goodbye.